Chapter 9. Jack Aubrey lay in his cot, savouring his resurrection. This was Sunday morning, and according to ancient naval custom, the day's life began half an hour earlier than usual. Hammocks were piped up at 6 bells rather than 7, so that the ship's people could wash, shave, and make themselves fine for divisions and church. Ordinarily, he was up and about with the rest. But today he deliberately took his ease, indulging in perfectly relaxed sloth and in the comfort of his bed, infinitely soft and well-moulded compared with harsh, scaly palm fronds, and infinitely warm and dry compared with the open sea. The usual swabs and holy stones scouring the deck a few feet above his head hadn't woken him, because Mowat had allowed nothing but silent, largely symbolic sweeping abaft the mainmast. But for all Mowat's care, Jack was pretty well aware of the time of the day. The intensity of the light and the smell of roasting coffee were in themselves a clock. Yet still he lay, taking conscious pleasure in being alive. At last, the scent of coffee died away, giving place to the everyday smell of fresh sea, tar, warm wood and cordage, and distant bilge. And his ear caught the click-click of Killick's mate's pestle grinding the beans in the brass mortar belonging to the sick bay. For Stephen was even more particular about his coffee than Jack, and having learnt the true Arabian way of preparing it when they were in the Red Sea, an otherwise profitless voyage, he'd banished the commonplace mill. Jack's ear also caught Killick's shrill abuse as his mate let some of the beans skip out. It had just the same tone of righteous indignation as the dreadful bosun's mates aboard the Pahi, or Sophie's mother, Mrs. Williams. He smiled again. How pleasant it was to be alive! Mrs. Williams had come to stay with them. His old and horribly energetic father, General Aubrey, a member of Parliament in the extreme radical interest, seemed bent on destroying Jack's career. Even apart from political considerations, the Admiralty had treated him with striking injustice ever since he was a master and commander, promising him ships and then giving them elsewhere, failing to promote his subordinates, though infinitely deserving, frequently questioning someone or another of the horribly intricate accounts he was required to keep, and regularly threatening him with unemployment, with being thrown on the shore there to live in wretched idleness on half pay. Yet how utterly trifling these things were, and the lawsuits too, in comparison with being alive. Stephen, a Catholic, had already performed his action of grace. Jack's happy, thankful mind now did much the same, though in a less formal manner, revelling and delighting in what he'd been given back. Light, pittering hooves could be heard overhead. Aspasia, fresh from her milking. It was even later than he'd thought, he observed, and he sat up. Killick had obviously been listening outside the door of the sleeping cabin, for it opened straight away, letting in a flood of eastern light. "Good morning, Killick," said Jack. "Good morning, sir," said Killick, holding up a towel. "Are you going to take a dip?" In these waters Jack usually swam before breakfast, even if it were only a plunge from the forechains, and a return by the stern ladder so as not to check the ship's way. But now, he said, no, he'd prefer a pot of hot water. His skin, and particularly the rolls of fat round his belly, were still strangely waterlogged, and at present sea-bathing had no attraction for him. "Is the doctor about yet?" he called, stropping his razor. "No, sir," said Killick from the great cabin where he was laying the breakfast table. "He was called up in the night, which Mr. Adams had a fit of the strong fives in consequence of eating and drinking too much by way of wishing the doctor joy of his return. But Eccleston soon settled his hash. Don't I wish I'd given it to him myself, the bugger? Added Killick in a low voice when he was sure that Jack couldn't hear, for the purser objected to Killick's way of robbing the foremast hands, the marines, the warrant officers, the midshipman's berth and the gunroom mess in order to keep the cabin well supplied. With their voices diminished by the distance and the following wind, Hollar and his mates could be heard calling down the hatchways, "Do you hear there, fore and aft? Clean shirt for muster at 5 bells, duck frocks and white trousers. Do you hear that? Clean shirt and shave for muster at 5 bells.
Clean shirt, sir,"
said Killick, passing it.
"Thank you, Killick,"
said Jack. He pulled on his second-best white breeches, observing with regret that in spite of his soaking and his privations they were still so tight round his waist that the topmost hook had to be left undone. His long waistcoat would cover the gap, however.
"Not far from 3 bells, sir," said Killick. "Too late to ask anyone else to breakfast, which is just as well, seeing as how Aspasia was precious near with her milk this morning."
Soft tack, and therefore toast, was as much a thing of the past as eggs and bacon or beefsteak and onions. But Jack's cook had turned out a highly spiced and savoury dish of Juan Fernandez stockfish, crisp on top. And Killick had produced one of the few remaining pots of Ashgrove Cottage marmalade, which went very well with ship's bread. "How I wish Sophie were here," he said aloud, looking at the label she'd written such a great way off. 3 bells sounded. He drank the last of the coffee, stood up, looped his sword belt over his shoulder and put on the splendid blue coat that Killick held out for him, a coat of singular elegance with its massive gold epaulettes and the ribbon of the Nile medal in a buttonhole, but one made of a stout broadcloth more calculated for the English Channel in winter than the equator. But, however, he reflected as his temperature rose, "I don't have to do it up. It's worse for the others." And in the gaiety of his heart he added, "Il faut souffrir pour être beau," as he clapped on his cocked hat. "Good morning, Oakes," he said to the marine sentry at his door, "and good morning, gentlemen," as he stepped onto the quarterdeck. In the general chorus of "good morning, sir," hats flew off, and immediately afterwards a dozen waistcoats partly vanished under close-buttoned coats. Automatically Jack looked up at the sails, the rigging, and the sky. All was just as he could wish. A whole topsail breeze in which she could carry the fore t'gallantsail if she were pressed. But the sea was not all he could wish by any means. The heavy blow that made him ship deadlights yesterday evening hadn't come about, but the following swell hadn't subsided. Indeed, the pitching made it difficult for the hands to arrange their bags, brought up so that the tween decks could be cleaned in the usual pyramid on the booms, and it was traversed by a curious diagonal cross swell that cut up the surface in an uneasy, fretful way. An ugly sea, and one that he wasn't used to in spite of all his experience. The forthcoming ceremony, however, was one that he knew by heart. It was performed in all well-regulated men-of-war once a week, except in a very heavy weather, and he must have seen it at least 1,000 times. The subdued conversation on the lee side of the quarter-deck died away. The quartermaster at the con cleared his throat, and as the last grain of sand fell into the lower part of the half-hour-glass, he cried, "Turn the glass and strike the bell." The marine on duty moved forward very careful of his step, with such a pitch and with the whole ship's company watching him, and struck 5 bells. "Mr. Boyle," said Maitland, the officer of the watch, to the young gentleman acting as mate of the watch, "beat to divisions." Boyle turned to the marine drummer, who stood there with his sticks poised, said, "beat to divisions," and the drum instantly roared out the Generale. The seamen,
who had been standing about in amorphous groups, taking great care of their best beautifully washed, ironed, and often embroidered clothes, now hurried to form lines according to their various divisions. Forecastlemen, topmen, gunners, and afterguard only. For the surprise had no wasters. Towing well-known seams on either side of the quarterdeck, on the gangways, and the forecastle. The marines were already drawn up far aft near the taffrail. The midshipmen inspected the hands in their division, tried to make them stand up straight and soldierly and stop talking, and then reported to the lieutenants and the master. The lieutenants and the master inspected them again, tried to make them stop staring about and hitching up their trousers, and reported that the men were present, properly dressed and clean, to Mowat, who stepped across the deck to Captain Aubrey, took off his hat and said, "All the officers have reported, sir." "Then we will go round the ship, Mr. Mowat, if you please," said Jack. And first he turned aft, to where the marines were standing as straight as ramrods in their scarlet coats. Their crossbelts were brilliant with pipe clay, their muskets and sidearms shone again, their hair was powdered to a turn, their leather stocks were as tight as stocks could well be and allow a little circulation of the blood. And although awnings had been rigged, the eastern sun, not yet at its height, beat on their backs with shocking force. They might not be beautiful, but they were certainly suffering. Accompanied by Howard, his sword drawn, and by Mowat, he passed along the rows of faces, many of them nameless to him even now, and all of them impersonal, gazing out beyond him wholly without expression. "Very creditable, Mr. Howard," said Jack. "I believe you may dismiss your men now. They may put on their duck jackets and wait quietly under the forecastle until church." Then, still with Mowat and with each of the divisional officers in turn, he went round the rest of the ship. This was quite a different ceremony. Here he knew every man, many of them, indeed most of them, intimately well. Knew their virtues, vices, particular skills, particular failings. And here there was no remote, impassive gaze, no eyes trained to avoid the charge of familiarity or dumb insolence. Far from it, they were very pleased to see him, and they smiled and nodded as he came by. Davis even laughed aloud. Furthermore, it was perfectly obvious to all concerned that a rescued captain, just returned to his ship by a combination of extraordinary luck and extraordinary exertions, couldn't decently find fault with his ship's company. As an inspection, his tour was, therefore, a matter of pure, though amiable, form, and it very nearly turned into a farce when the bosun's cat joined them and marched steadily in front of the captain, its tail in the air. Far below, under the grateful freshness of a windsail, Stephen was sitting with his patient Martin. They were not exactly bickering, but in both the spirit of contradiction was distinctly present and active, present in the chaplain because of his wounds, and in Stephen because of a more than usually wretched night on top of two really trying days. "That may be so," said he, "yet in the public mind the service is often associated with drunkenness, sodomy, and brutal punishment." "I was in the great English public school," said Martin, "and the vices to which you refer were by no means uncommon there. They are, I believe, fairly usual whenever a large number of men are gathered together. But what's unusual in the service, and what I've not encountered elsewhere, is the essential good nature. I don't speak of the seaman's courage and altruism, which need no comments of mine, though I shall never forget those noble fellows who dragged me back into the boat from the Pahi." Stephen, cross-grained though he was that morning, really couldn't disagree. He waited until Martin had finished and then said, "You didn't happen to notice a tall, slim, broad-shouldered young woman with a spear, very like an undraped Athene?"
"No,"
said Martin. I saw nothing but a swarthy crew of ill-looking female savages, full of malignant fury, a disgrace to their sex.
I dare say they'd been ill-used, the creatures, said Stephen.
Perhaps they had, said Martin. But to carry resentment to the point of the emasculation you described seems to me inhuman and profoundly wicked. Though, as far as unsexking's concerned, who are we to throw stones? With us, any girl that cannot find a husband is unsexed. If she's very high or very low, she may go her own way with the risks entailed therein, but otherwise she must either have no sex or be disgraced. She burns and she is ridiculed for burning. To say nothing of male tyranny, a wife or a daughter being a mere chattel in most codes of law or custom, and brute force. To say nothing of that, hundreds of thousands of girls are in effect unsexed every generation, and barren women are as much despised as eunuchs. I do assure you, Martin, that if I were a woman, I should march out with a flaming torch and a sword. I should emasculate right and left. As for the women of the pie, I'm astonished at their moderation. You would have been still more astonished at the force of their blows. It's the black shame of the world that they should be deprived of the joys of love. Tiresias said they were 10 times as great as those enjoyed by men, or was it 30? Leaving aside the far more dubious pleasures of motherhood and keeping house, Tiresias represents no more than the warm imaginings of Homer. Decent women take no pleasure in the act, but only seek to... Nonsense! I quite agree with you in your dislike of interruptions, Maturin, said Martin.
I beg your pardon.
Stephen cocked his ear to the mouth of the windsill and said, what's all that huzzaing on deck?
No doubt they've taken the party, and now you'll be able to carry your charitable theories into practice,
said Martin, but without any real ill humour. They both listened attentively, and while they were listening, feet came running aft. Padin opened the door and stood there, making inarticulate sounds, pointing a thumb over his shoulder.
Himself, is it?
Asked Stephen. Padin smiled and nodded and passed Stephen his coat. Stephen put it on, buttoned it, and stood up as the captain and the first lieutenant came in.
Good morning, Doctor,
said Jack.
How are your patients?
Good morning, sir,
said Stephen.
Some are a little contradictory and fractious, but a comfortable slime draught at noon will deal with that. The others do tolerably well and are looking forward to their Sunday duff.
I'm heartily glad to hear it. And I believe you'll be glad to hear that we've picked up another of the Norfolk's barrels. A pork barrel this time, fresh and floating high, marked Boston in December of last year.
Does that mean we're close to her?
There's no telling within a week or so, but it does mean that we're probably in the same ocean.
After some more remarks about barrels, their drifting and signs of wear, Martin said,
I believe, sir, that you mean to read one of Dean Dunn's sermons this morning.
I've told Killick just where to find it.
Yes, sir, I thank you, and he did find it. But now that I've looked it over, I feel that it would come better from a learned man, from a real parson. I shall confine myself to the Articles of War, which I do understand, and which, in any case, are obliged to be read once a month.
This he did.
In the pause that followed the singing of the Old Hundredth, Ward, who on these occasions acted as parish clerk as well as captain's clerk, stepped forward, took the slim folio of the Articles from beneath the Bible and passed it to Jack, who began in a strong, minatory voice, though not without a certain relish,
for the regulating and better government of His Majesty's navies, ships of war and forces by sea, whereon, under the good providence of God, the wealth, safety, and strength of this kingdom chiefly depend, Be it enacted by the King's Most Excellent Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Lords Spiritual and Temporal, and Commons in this present Parliament assembled. His words came down the windsail in snatches as the breeze strengthened on the top of the swell and diminished when the surprise sank into the trough, and fragments of the articles mingled with Stephen's and Martin's conversation, which now moved off by way of the phalarope to the less dangerous ground of birds.
"Did you ever see a phalarope at all?"
asked Stephen.
"Never a live one, alas. Only in the pages of a book, and that a most indifferent cut."
"Will I describe him to you?"
"If you please."
"All flag officers and all persons in or belonging to His Majesty's ship or vessels of war, being guilty of profane oaths, cursings, execrations, drunkenness, uncleanliness, or other scandalous actions in derogation of God's honour and corruption of good manners."
"But the hen bird is much larger and much brighter, and she is a creature that doesn't believe that a hen's duty is merely to tend her nest, brood her eggs, and nourish her chicks. I once had the happiness of watching a pair from a fisherman's cabin on the far, far tip of the County Mayo. There was a group of them in the neighbourhood, but it was this particular pair I watched so close to the cabin they were.
If any ship or vessel shall be taken as prize, none of the officers, mariners, or other persons on board her shall be stripped of their clothes, or in any sort pillaged, beaten, or evilly treated.
The evening she'd laid the last of her clutch..."
"Forgive me," said Martin, laying his hand upon Stephen's knee.
"But how many?"
"Four. Snipe-shaped, and much the same colours. That same evening, then, she was away, and the poor cock had to look after them himself. I was afraid some harm had come to her, but not at all. There she was, and I knew her well from her face and the odd white streak on the side of her bosom, swimming about on the sea and the little loch this side of it, and playing with the other hens and the unattached cocks. And all the while the poor fellow brooded the eggs there, not 15 yards from me under a turf stack, covering them as well as he could from the rain, and never eating but 5 minutes or so in the day. It was worse when they hatched, because clearly they had to be fed single-handed, the four of them bawling and screeching all the day long, and he wasn't very handy at cleaning up after them either. He grew anxious and thin and partially bald, and there she was, on the loch, chasing the other phalaropes and being chased by them, crying, 'Bleep, bleep, bleep,' and never doing a beast turn by way of labour or toil. There was a fowl that knew how to live a life of her own, I believe."
"But surely, Matron, as a married man, you cannot approve the phalarope hen?"
"Why, as to that," said Stephen, with a sudden vivid image of Diana dancing a quadrille, "perhaps she may carry things a little far. But it does go some way towards redressing a balance that is so shamefully down on the one side alone. Any person in the fleet who shall unlawfully burn or set fire to any magazine or store of powder or ship, boat, ketch, hoy or vessel, tackle or furniture thereunto belonging, not then appertaining to an enemy pirate or rebel, shall suffer death."
These words came down the ventilator with unusual force. And after a rather solemn pause, Martin asked,
"Just how does one define a hoy, Maturin?"
"As this is a Sunday, I will tell you candidly that I don't know," said Stephen. "But I have heard it used by way of reproach as 'you infernal two-masted Dutch hoy,' or 'the place was all a hoo like the deck of the Gravesend hoy.'"
Only a very little later, Jack used these same words, "as this is a Sunday," when he refused a request submitted by the hands through the captains of the tops to the boatswain, by him to the first lieutenant, and by Mowat to the captain. The idea was that, as the doctor was very curious to see a prize fight,
His return to the ship might be celebrated by a series of contests on the forecastle that evening. The more so as the marines and even the whalers had long been prating of their extraordinary skill and courage in the ring.
"No," said Jack, "as this is a Sunday, I'm afraid I cannot countenance prize fighting." "I'm sure Mr. Martin would agree that Sunday is no day for semi-slaughter, for real fighting, bare-knuckle fighting. But if they choose to ask sales to run out properly padded gloves, and if they like to set to sparring and boxing like Christians, with nothing on the murdering lay, no wrestling, no cross buttock falls or gouging or strangling, no head in chancery or catching hold of pigtails, why, I can't see that the Archbishop of Canterbury himself could object." Then, turning to Stephen, "I never knew you were interested in prize fighting."
"You never asked.
I've seen many a squalid scuffle, of course, many a Donnybrook fair. But as I was telling Bondon the other day, although it is so much a part of modern life, I have never seen the peculiarly English prize fighting. I was very near to it once. I met a particularly amiable young man in a stagecoach, a pugilist named Henry Pierce."
"The game chicken?" cried Jack and Mowat together.
"I dare say. They told me he was a famous man. And he invited me to see him fight some other hero. Thomas Cribb, was it? But at the last moment I was disappointed of my treat."
"So you met the game chicken," said Mowat, looking at Stephen with a new respect. "I saw him fight the whopping slasher on ups and downs until they were both of them groggy and very nearly blind with blood. And after an hour and 17 minutes and 41 rounds, Pierce was the only one who could come up to the scratch, although he'd had 5 knockdown blows and the slasher had fallen on him twice. Squelch, with all his weight, the way some bruisers do when there's a big purse."
"How you've missed seeing one in all this time, I can't tell," said Jack, who had often travelled 50 miles to see Mendoza or Belcher or Dutch Sam, who had frequented Gentleman Jackson's establishment and who had himself lost 2 teeth in friendly encounters. "But at least that can be repaired this evening. We've got some capital bruisers aboard. Bondon won the belt at Pompey, with 8 ships of the line and 3 frigates competing. Davis is a smiter that will stand like a Trojan until his legs are cut from under him, and one of the whalers is said to be very dangerous. Mowat, the hide we use for covering the lanyards would be better than sailcloth if we have any that's supple enough. I'll go and see, sir."
"Lord, Stephen," said Jack when they were alone, "how pleasant it is to be aboard again, don't you find?"
"Certainly," said Stephen. "Only this morning I was thinking how right they were to say it was better to be a dead horse than a live lion." He gazed out of the scuttle, obviously going over the words in his mind. "No, I mean, better to flog a dead horse than a live lion."
"I quite agree.
Yet even that's not quite right, neither. I know there's a dead horse in it somewhere. But I'm afraid I'm brought by the lee this time, though I rather pride myself on proverbs, bringing them in aptly, you know, and to the point."
"Never distress yourself, brother.
There is no mistake, I'm sure. It's a valuable saying, and one that admonishes us never to underestimate our enemy. For whereas flogging a dead horse is child's play, doing the same to a lion is potentially dangerous, even though one may take a long spoon. In this case, the enemy was the swell. And in their eagerness for the entertainment, all those concerned had underestimated it and continued to do so, in spite of the evidence of their senses up to, and indeed beyond, the last possible moment.
Even when it had increased to such an extent that the ship was pitching headrails under and a man could scarcely keep his feet without holding on, there were those who swore it was all a mere flurry. It would die away well before sunset. They should certainly have their fight, and any ugly Dutch-billed bugger that spoke to the contrary was a croaker, a goddamn crow, a fool, and no seaman.
"I'm afraid you'll be disappointed of your treat again," said Jack.
"But if this sea dies down, and if the work of the ship allows, you shall have it tomorrow." The swell, in so far as it was a vast regular up and down, certainly diminished. Yet Stephen, lying there awake in the morning, felt a strange, uneasy motion that was neither a strong pitching nor a heavy roll, but a quick, sudden kind of lurching with no decided direction, unlike anything he'd known before. This lurching caused the ship's timbers to work, and it had obviously been going on for some considerable time, since there was a good deal of water washing to and fro in his cabin, and his shoes were afloat. "Pardine!" he called several times. And after a listening pause, "Where is that black thief, his soul to the devil?"
"Can't Mary be with you, gentlemen?" said Pardine, opening the door and letting more water in.
"God and Mary be with you," said Stephen, "and Patrick." Pardine pointed upwards through the decks, and after some gasps he said in English,
"The devil's abroad."
"I dare say he is," said Stephen. "Listen, Pardine, just reach me those dry shoes from the little net on the wall, will you now?" His cabin was not far from the ship's centre of gravity, and as he made his way up the ladders, the motion increased so that twice he was nearly flung off, once sideways and once backwards. The only person in the gunroom was Howard's marine servant, who said with a frightened look, "All the gentlemen are on deck, Your Honour." So they were. Even the purser and even Honey, who had had the graveyard watch and who should have been fast asleep. But in spite of the gathering, there was little talk, and apart from good mornings, Stephen himself said not a word. The horizon all round was of a blackish purple, and over the whole sky there rolled great masses of cloud of a deep copper colour, moving in every direction with a strange, unnatural speed. Lightning flashed almost continually in every part, and the air was filled with the tremble of enormous thunder, far astern but travelling nearer. There was a steep, irregular sea, bursting with a tremendous surf, as though under the impulsion of a very hard gale. In fact, the breeze was no more than moderate, yet in spite of its moderation it was strikingly cold, and it whistled through the rigging with a singularly keen and shrilling note. The topgallant masts had already been struck down on deck, and all hands were now busy securing the boats on the booms with double gripes, sending up preventer stays, shrouds, braces and backstays, clapping double breechings onto the guns, covering the forehatch and scuttles with tarpaulins and battening them down. Aspasia came and nuzzled his hand, pressing against his leg like an anxious dog. A sudden jerk nearly had him over, but he saved himself by grasping her horns.
"Hold on, Doctor," called Jack from the windward rail. "The bark is skittish today." "But what does all this signify?"
asked Stephen. "Something of a blow," said Jack.
"Forecastle there, Mr. Boyle. Guide to the Cathead."
"I'll tell you at breakfast. Have you seen the bird?"
"I have not. No bird these many days. What kind of bird?"
"A sort of albatross, I believe, or perhaps a prodigious great mew. He's been following the ship since..." "There he is, crossing the wake. He comes up the side."
Stephen caught a glimpse of wings, huge wings, and he ran forward along the gangway to get a clear view from the bows. The fall from the gangway into the waist of the ship was not much above 6 feet, but Stephen was flung off with unusual force, and he hit his head on the iron breech of a gun. They carried him aft and laid him on Jack's cot, dead apart from a just perceptible breathing and a very faint pulse.
It was here that Martin found him, having crawled up from the depths.
"How good of you to come, Mr. Martin," cried Jack. "But surely you shouldn't be about with your leg. I only sent to ask whether you thought he should be let blood, since you understand physic. We cannot bring him round."
"I cannot advise letting blood," said Martin, having felt Stephen's unresisting, impassive head.
"Nor brandy," glancing at the two bottles, one from the cabin, one from the gunroom. "I do know something of physic, and am persuaded this is a cerebral commotion, not a full coma, since there's no stertor, which must be treated by rest, quiet, darkness. I will consult the doctor's books, if I may, but I don't think they'll contradict me in this. Nor will I say that he would be far better downstairs, where the sideways motion is so much less."
"You're quite right, I'm sure," said Jack. And to Killick, "Pass the word for Bondon. Bondon, can you and Coleman and, say, Davis carry the doctor below without jerking him, or should you be happier with a tackle?"
"A tackle too, sir, if you please. I wouldn't slip with him, no, not for a world of gold."
"Make it so then, Bondon," said Jack. And while the tackles were being set up, "What do you think, Mr. Martin? Is he bad? Is he in danger?"
"My opinion isn't worth a great deal, but this is obviously much more than an ordinary stunning fall. I've read of comatose states of such a kind lasting for days, sometimes growing deeper and ending in death, sometimes giving way and dispersing like natural sleep. When there's no bone broken, I believe internal hemorrhage is often the deciding factor."
"All ready, sir," said Bondon. The strongest men in the ship were with him, and between them, wedged against stanchions and bulkheads, they lowered Stephen inch by inch, as though his skin were made of eggshell, until he was back in his own cot, with Padine by to curb its swinging. The cabin was small and somewhat airless, but it was dark, it was quiet. It was in the least agitated part of the ship, and here the hours passed over him in black silence. On deck, all hell broke loose as they were striking the maintopmast half an hour later. The preventer top rope reeved through the fithole, parted at the very moment a deluge of warm rain beat down on the ship, so thick they could scarcely breathe, much less see. From that time on until full darkness and beyond, it was an incessant battle, with mad blasts of wind from every direction, thunder and lightning right overhead, unbelievably steep seas that made no sense at all, bursting with such force that they threatened to engulf the ship, bursting as though they were over a reef, although there was no bottom to be found with any line the ship possessed. All this, and such freaks as a waterspout that collapsed on their astonished heads, bringing the main deck level with the surface for several minutes, and without a pause, thunder bellowed about them, while St. Elmo's fire flickered and blazed on the bowsprit and catheads. It was a time, or rather, since ordinary time was gone by the board, a series of instant shifts and expedients, of surviving from one stunning thunderclap and invasion of water to the next, and between them making fast such things as the jolly boat, the binnacle itself, and the booms that had carried away. And all the while the pumps turned like fury, flinging out tons of water that the sea or the sky flung right back again. Yet even so, it was the hands at the pumps who were the least harassed, although they had to work until they could hardly stand, often up to their middles in water, often half choked with flying spray or still more rain, immeasurable quantities of rain. At least they knew exactly what to do. For the others, it was a perpetually renewed state of emergency in which anything might happen. Unheard of, shockingly dangerous accidents, such as the 70-foot palm trunk that a freakish sea flung bodily aboard, so that its far end wedged in the main shrouds while the rest lashed murderously to and fro, sweeping the gangways and the forecastle, just as an equally freakish squall took what little storm canvas the ship dared show full aback, checking her, as though she'd run onto a reef and laying her so far over that many thought she was gone at last. Indeed, if a windward gun had broken loose at this point of utmost strain, it would certainly have plunged right through her side. It was not until sunset that the weather began to have a direction and some sort of a meaning. The whirling, turning, formless blasts passed north and westwards, and they were succeeded by the pent-up southeast wind, which, though full of flaws and slanting squalls, blew with enormous force, eventually bringing up a swell which rivalled that they'd known in the '50s so very far south. It was a hard blow, a very, very hard blow, with a dangerous following sea. But it was what they were used to in their calling, and compared with the maniac day, it was positive relief. The hands were piped by half-watch and half-watch to their very late supper. Jack ordered the splicing of the main brace and made his way below. He went first to the sick bay, where he knew there'd be some injured men, and there Ivan Martin, splinting Hogg's broken arm in the most workmanlike fashion. Pratt was standing by with bandages and lint, and it was clear that Martin had taken over. "This is very good of you, Mr. Martin," he cried. "I hope you're not in too much pain yourself. There's blood on your bandage." "Not at all," said the parson. "I took Maturin's potion, the tincture. But pray hold this end for a moment, and feel very little. I've just come from him. I found no change. Mrs. Lamb is with him at present. I'll look at your other patients, and then, if it would do no harm, I'll go and see him." Considering the extraordinary severity of the day, there were surprisingly few casualties, and apart from the broken arm, none very serious. He felt encouraged as he went down the ladder, and quite hopeful as he opened the cabin door. But there, under the swinging lantern, Stephen looked like a dead man. His temples were sunk, his nostrils pinched, his lips were colourless. He was lying on his back, and his grey, closed, utterly motionless face had an inhuman lack of expression. "I thought he was gone not 5 minutes ago," said Mrs. Lamb. "Perhaps with the turning of the tide..." There was no change at two bells in the middle watch, when Jack came down to sit with him for a while before turning in. There was no change when Martin hobbled up to take a first breath of morning air on the ravaged quarter-deck, desolation fore and aft, and stood for a while watching the ship tearing along under no more than close-reefed topsail and jib over a dark, indigo sea, laced with white streams of foam and broken water, tearing along with fag-ends of rope flying, broken spars at every turn, and the rigging giving out a general note two full tones lower than usual, tearing along just ahead of great following seas that rose to the height of the mizzen top. "What shall you do now?" he asked at breakfast in the gunroom, after he'd answered all their questions about Stephen. "Do?" said Mowat. "Why, what any ship must do in such a blow. Scud and pray we're not pooped, and that we may not run into anything by night. Scud, knotting and splicing as we go." There was no change when Martin came to a makeshift dinner in the cabin. Jack said, "I'm not to teach you anything about medicine, Mr. Martin, but it occurred to me that as the injury was much the same as Place's, perhaps the same operation might answer." "I, too, have been thinking of that," said Martin. "And now I've had time to read in some of his books on the subject. Although I find no depressed fracture in this case, which is the usual reason for trepanning, I fear there may be a clot of extravasated blood under the point of impact, which is having the same effect." "Should you not try the operation, then wouldn't it relieve the brain?" "I shouldn't dare to do so."
"You turned the handle when Place was done."
"Yes, but I had an expert by me. No, no, there are many other considerations. I have a great deal more to read. Much of it's dark to me. In any case, no amateur could possibly operate with a ship in such a state of violent motion.
Jack was obliged to admit the truth of this, but his face grew stern and he tapped his biscuit on the table for a few moments before forcing a smile and saying,
"I promised to tell you about the weather when we had time to draw breath. It seems that we were on the southern side and near the tail of a typhoon that has travelled off northwesterly. That would account for the whirlwinds and the seas from every quarter, don't you agree, Mert?"
"Yes, sir," said Mert. "And we're certainly in quite different waters now. Have you noticed the quantities of long, thin, pale sharks around the ship? One of them took the bullock's hide we had towing under the main chains to soften it. When I went below to ask Hogg how he did, he said he'd often seen them approaching the Marquesas. He also said he didn't think the weather had blown itself out yet. No, not by a chalk as long as your arm."
Dinner ended on that note.
As Martin took his leave, he said he would pass the afternoon reading, very attentively watching the patient's symptoms, and perhaps practising with the trephine on some of the seals' skulls he and Maturin possessed. Late that night, he said he was becoming more and more nearly convinced that the operation was called for. Above all, since Stephen's breathing had now become slightly stertorous, and he showed passages in Pott and La Fay supporting his view. But what, he asked, was the use of his growing conviction with the ship plunging about like this? In so delicate an operation, the slightest lurch, the slightest want of balance and exact control might mean the patient's death. Would it be possible to heave the ship to? That would make no difference to the absolute motion, said Jack. Indeed, it would make the heave and roll come quicker. No, the only hope is that this sea should go down, which, bar a miracle, it can't do in less than 3 or 4 days, or that we should lie to under the lee of some reef or island. But there is no reef or island laid down on the chart until we reach the Marquesas. Of course, there is the alternative that you should... How shall I put it? That you should steel yourself to the act. After all, naval surgeons can't wait for calm weather, and if I remember right, place was operated on in a close-reefed topsail breeze.
Very true. Though the sea was fairly calm, yet we must distinguish between timidity and temerity, and in any case, even if I were quite certain it was right, in view of my inexperience and remaining doubts, I certainly couldn't operate without the full light of day.
But even when the full light of day came, it didn't bring full conviction. Martin was still torn with uncertainty.
I cannot bear the sight of Maturin just fading away like this for want of care. For want of a bold stroke, said Jack.
The pulse under his attentive fingers was now so faint that it wasn't above once in 5 minutes that he could be sure of it.
I cannot bear the thought of Maturin being killed by my want of skill or by some wretched jerk of the deck under me, said Martin,
whose improvised Lavoisier trephine had made some shocking plunges right through the practiced skulls.
Fools rush in where angels fear to tread.
The surprise raced westwards over the same dark blue, enormously heaving sea, under a brilliant sky filled with high white clouds, re-rigging, re-reeving, fishing the sprung mizzenmast. Her main shrouds on the weather side, shattered by the palm trunk, had already been replaced, set up and rattled down, and her captain had his usual walk restored. The quarter-deck was just 50 feet long, and by stepping short at a particular ring-bolt, now worn thin and silver-bright, he could make 50 of his turns fore and aft amount to a measured mile by land.
Up and down he went amid the busy noise of the ship and the steady, omnipresent, great voice of the wind and the very powerful sea. With his bowed head and his stern expression, he seemed so absorbed that the other people on the quarterdeck spoke very quietly and kept well over to leeward. But he was, in fact, perfectly aware of what was going forward, and at the first cry of "Land ho!" from the main top, he sprang into the shrouds. It was a furious, hard climb, with the huge wind tearing him sideways and his shirt tail out billowing round his ears, and he was glad the lookout had been sent no higher. "Where away, Sims?" he asked, coming into the top through the lubber hole. 3 points on the starboard bow, sir," said Sims, pointing, and there, indeed, as the ship rose on the swell, was land, quite high land with a hint of green, an island some 11 or 12 leagues away. "Well done, Sims," said Jack, and he slipped down through the hole again. Even before he reached the deck, he began roaring for the bosun, who was busy on the forecastle. "Leave that for the moment, Mr. Holler," he said, "and get me light hawsers to the mastheads." "Aye, aye, sir," said Holler, smiling. This was an old trick of the captain's, horrible in appearance but wonderfully effective. The hairy, brutish hawsers and cablets allowed him to carry sail that would otherwise tear the masts out of the ship, and this had won the frigate many a charming prize before now, or had allowed her to run clear away from much superior force. "Mr. Merritt," he said, "four good men to the wheel, and let them be relieved every glass. We're going to crack on. Mr. Allen, please to con the ship. Course northwest by west to half west." Then, half an hour later, catching sight of Hogg, supported by his mates on the gangway, he stepped forward and said, "Well, Spectioneer, do you make it out?"
"Yes, mate, I do," said Hogg. "If you look under them clouds not moving under their floor, like, don't you see a bright round and dark in the middle?"
"I believe I do."
"Yes, certainly I do. The bright is surf and coral sand, and the dark is trees. There ain't much lagoon."
"How do you know that?"
"Why, because lagoon shows green, in course. Quite a high island from the amount of cloud. I wonder you never saw it, Bill."
This to his supporter.
"'Tis as plain as plain." "All stretched along in a tanto, sir," said the bosun. "Very good, Mr. Holler," said Jack. And raising his voice, "All hands to make sail."
The new course brought the great wind almost onto the frigate's quarter, and methodically he began spreading her canvas. They'd long since swayed up the topmasts, though not, of course, the topgallants, and he gave her a little high storm jib first, then the main staysail, then, instead of the close-reefed main topsail, the main topmast staysail. Each time he paused for the surprise to take up the full force of the new thrust. This she did with immense spirit, with the buoyant, living grace which so moved his heart. Never was such a ship. And when she was moving perhaps as fast as she'd ever moved, with her lee cathead well under the foam of her bow wave, he laid one hand on the hanses, feeling the deep note of her hull as he might have felt the vibrations of his fiddle, and the other on a backstay, gauging the exact degree of strain. They were used to the captain. They'd nearly all of them seen him cracking on like smoke and oakum, and they were pretty nearly sure he hadn't finished. But no man had expected his call for the forecourse itself, and it was with grave, anxious faces that they jumped to their task. It took 57 men to haul the foresheaft aft, to tally and belay. And as the strain increased, so the surprise healed another strake. Another, and yet another. Until she showed a broad streak of copper on her windward side, while the howl in the rigging rose shriller and shriller, almost to the breaking note. And there she steadied,
racing through the sea and flinging a bow wave so high to leeward that the sun sent back a double rainbow. Discreet cheering started forward and spread aft. Everybody on the quarterdeck was grinning.
"Watch your dog, Vane," said Jack to the helmsman. "If you once let her be brought by the lee, you'll never see Portsmouth Point again. Mr. Howard, pray let your men line the weather gangway."
Four bells. Boyle walked cautiously down the sloping deck with the log and reel under his arm, followed by a quartermaster with a little sand glass.
"Double the stray line,"
called Jack, who wanted an accurate measurement, with the log ship well clear of the wake before the knots were counted.
"Double the stray line it is, sir,"
replied Boyle in as deep a voice as his puny frame could manage. When the red tuft had been shifted 15 fathoms, he took up his station by the rail, asked,
"Is your glass clear?" And on being told, "Glass clear, sir,"
heaved the log well out, holding the reel high in his left hand.
"Turn,"
he cried as the end of the stray line went by. The sand streamed down, the reel whirred, the knots fleeted by, intently watched by all hands who had an eye to spare. The quartermaster opened his mouth to cry, "Nip!" But before the last grains had shot through, Boyle uttered a screech, and the reel shot from his hand.
"I'm very sorry, sir," he said to Mowat after a moment's confusion. "I let the reel go."
Mowat stepped across to Jack and said, "Boyle's very sorry, sir, but he let the reel go. The line ran clean out, and I suppose the pin was stiff. It took him unawares."
"Never mind," said Jack, who, in spite of his intense underlying anxiety, was deeply moved by this splendid measurement of flying speed. "Let him try with a 14-second glass at 6 bells.
By 6 bells, the upper part of the island was clear to those on the deck, a hilly little island with clouds just above it. And from the main top could be seen the tremendous surf beating against its shore. No lagoon on this windward side, but there seemed to be reefs running out some way on the northeast and southwest, with lighter coloured water beyond them. The wind had diminished by now, and the Surprise logged no astonishing number of knots. But there was that ineffaceable memory dear to all the people of a whole 150 fathoms being run straight off the reel before the glass was out. And in any case, she was still bringing the land a mile closer every 4 or 5 minutes.
"Mr. Martin," said Jack in the sick bay, "we've raised an island, as I dare say you know, and in an hour's time we should be under its lee. Or it may be possible to land. In either case, I beg you'll hold yourself in readiness to operate."
"Let's go and look at him," said Martin. Padine Coleman was sitting there, his beads in his hand. He shook his head without a word, meaning no change.
"It is an awful decision," said Martin, as they stood swaying with the motion of the ship, looking down at that stern mast. "Above all, because the symptoms do not quite agree with any of the books. Once again," and this time at greater length, he explained what he understood to be the nature of the case. He was still doing so when Mowat came and said softly, "I beg your pardon, sir, but there's a signal flying from the island."
The island had come very much closer during Jack's time below, and the signal was quite clear in his glass. A torn blue and white flag on a high-standing rock. Jack climbed into the foretop with his first lieutenant, and from there the shoreline was as plain as could be. Cliffs with rollers bursting high on them on the eastern side,
and then a reef tending away southward and west. He called down the orders that put the ship before the wind under a close-reefed main topsail and forecourse. She skirted the edge of the reef and hauled up round it, coming to the verge of the island's lee. Here the reef enclosed a considerable lagoon, and on its landward shore, intensely white under this brilliant sky, he saw a number of men, probably white men from the trousers and occasional shirt. Some were running to and fro, but more were making emphatic gestures northwards. The Surprise, with little more than steerage way on her now, moved cautiously along the outside of the reef. Quite close, but still in such deep water that the man in the chains perpetually cried out, "No bottom with this line! No bottom! Nay, nay!" Although there was still a powerful swell, the wind was very, very much less here, and its near silence gave their slow gliding the feeling of a dream. The reef slipped by, sometimes with little palm-grown islands on it, coconut palms, often laid flat or broken off short, and beyond the reef, the calm lagoon. Beyond that, the shining strand, backed first by palms and then by a rising general greenery, whose wind-ravaged state could be seen only in a glass. And on the strand the white men ran and capered and pointed. They weren't much more than a mile away, but the shifting airs under the island's lee didn't carry their voices, which were reduced to an occasional faint "Ahoy! The ship ahoy!" or a confused babbling. "I believe that's a gap, sir," said Mowat, pointing along the broad reef. And just beyond, an island with three uprooted palms and three still standing, there was indeed a channel through into the lagoon. "Flat in further," cried Jack, staring intently. And as the Surprise edged nearer to the gap, he heard a concerted howl from the strand, no doubt a warning, for a sunken ship lay clean across the fairway. An unnecessary warning, however. In this clear water and with the ebbing tide, she was clear from her stem, which was wedged just below the surface in the coral of the little island, to her stern far down in the rocks of the other side. Her bowsprit and masts had gone by the board, her back was broken, her midship gun ports had been stove in, and there was a gaping hole from her starboard main chains to her quarter gallery, a hole through which passed long, pale grey sharks, blurred by the ripple and the swell. But she was perfectly recognisable as the Norfolk, and Jack had once called out, "Hoist the short pennant and the colours." This seemed to cause some consternation on shore. Most of the men ran off northwards. A few still stood staring. The capering stopped, and there were no more gestures. Jack returned to the quarter-deck, and the ship sailed gently on, following the reef. The shore turned inward, opening a little cove in which there stood a cluster of tents and shelters, where a stream ran out of the woods over the sand. Here there were more people, more distant now that the lagoon was wider and quite inaudible. But now, evidently by command, they all pointed their right arms northwards to the place where the stream flowed through a long winding channel in the reef, quarter of a mile broad at this point. There were no breakers here, on this most sheltered part of the coast. But even so, the swell still rose high on the glistening coral and receded with an enormous sigh. "I'll be damned if I venture the ship in there on an ebbing tide without sounding," said Jack, looking at the light green channel, and he ordered a boat away. "It could just be done," said Honey, returning, "but it would be nip and tuck until the flood, and the coral rocks on either side and on the bottom were razor sharp.
There was no great current now near Slackwater, but the tide must scour through at a great rate to keep the bottom so clean, unless indeed that was the effect of the heavy blow.
If the ship were to go through, perhaps he'd better buoy one or two of the worst places.
Nah, said Jack, it don't signify. We're in 40 fathom water with a good clean ground. We could anchor if we chose. Mr. Mowat, while I stand off and on, take my barge and a proper guard of marines, proceed to the shore, flag a truce at Ensign, of course, present my compliments to the captain of the Norfolk, and desire him to repair aboard without delay and surrender himself prisoner. The barge hadn't been painted since they were off the River Plate. The bargemen hadn't had time to renew their broad-brimmed sennit hats. The uniforms of the lieutenant, the midshipmen and the marines were not as fresh as they had been before undergoing Antarctic cold and equatorial heat. But even so, the surprises were quite proud of their turnout, so very far from home and after such an uncommon savage blow. They watched the barge thread the channel and cross the broad, smooth lagoon. And during the long pull, many of the watch below passed a small private telescope from hand to hand, looking for women on the shore. In spite of their shocking experience with the Pahi, they still looked for women, looked very eagerly indeed. Those who had been in the South Sea before had attentive, silent listeners. As free and kind she was as kiss my hand, said Hogg, speaking of the first he had known in the island of Oahua. And so were the rest. Some of the men had to be tied and carried aboard, slung on a pole. They would have jumped ship else, though they had 40 and 50 pounds due to them in shares.
There ain't no women, said Place to a young main-topman after a long and searching stare. Nor no men, neither. It's a desert island, apart from those Boston beans walking up and down. But that there sheltering the biggest tent by the stream, that's a breadfruit tree, I dare say.
You can stuff your breadfruit tree,
said the young topman bitterly.
That's no way to talk to a man old enough to be your dad, Ned Harris, said the captain of the forecastle. Saucy young bugger, said two others.
Pony meant it by way of a joke, said Harris, reddening. I was talking light-hearted.
You want your arse tanned,
observed the yeoman of the signals.
It's a precious lot of sharks about, said Harris, by way of changing the subject. Uncommon long, thin grey ones.
Never you mind if they're grey or pink with orange stripes, said the captain of the forecastle. You just keep a civil tongue in your head, Ned Harris, that's all.
They're putting off for the American captain, sir, said Killick in the cabin. Undo this damned hook for me, will you, Killick? Said Jack, who was getting into his uniform. I must be growing fat.
He looked into his dining cabin, where a cold collation had been spread to welcome the captain of the Norfolk, ate one of the little salt biscuits, and then buckled on his sword. He didn't wish to appear too eager, strutting about on his quarter-deck throughout his prisoner's approach. It was a damned unpleasant thing having to surrender in any case, as he knew from experience, without having people crow over you. But, on the other hand, he didn't wish to appear casual, as though the surrender of a post-captain were of no great importance. He waited until it seemed to him that the moment was as nearly right as possible, put on his cocked hat and went on deck. A quick look showed him that Honey had everything in hand, midshipmen quite respectable, side boys washed and holding their white gloves ready, rather hairy, big-boned side boys now, marines at hand, and the ship, which had been to-ing and fro-ing now, standing gently in, just stemming the tide, to receive the barge. He began his usual pacing. But at the third turn, a glance at the short figure sitting there between Calamy and Mowat and the stern sheets made him look again. Look much harder. It was too late to start staring with a spyglass, but from his time as a prisoner of war in Boston, He was very well acquainted with American naval uniforms, and there was something amiss. When the barge was a little nearer, he said to the marine sentry, "Trollope, hail that boat." The marine was on the point of saying, "But it's our own barge, sir," when a glazed, disciplined look came over his eyes. He shut his mouth, drew a deep breath, and called, "The boat, ahoy!" "No, no," came Bondon's answer, very loud and clear, meaning that no commissioned officer was coming to the surprise. "Carry on, Mr. Honey," said Jack, withdrawing to the taff rail. The side boys stuffed their gloves into their pockets, the midshipmen abandoned their reverential looks, and Howard dismissed his men. The barge hooked on, and Mowat bounded up the side. His face was quite aghast as he came hurrying after Jack. "I'm very sorry, sir," he cried, "but the war is over." He was immediately followed by a cheerful, short, thick, round-headed man in a plain uniform coat who brushed past Honey and approached Jack with a beaming smile, his hand held out.
"My dear Captain Aubrey, give you joy of the peace," he said. "I'm delighted to see you again, and how is your arm?" "Very well, I see, and much the same length as the other, according to my prediction. You... oh, don't remember me, sir, though without boasting I may say you owe me your right arm." "Mr. Evans was actually filing the teeth of his saw when I said, 'No, let's give it another day.'" "Butcher, formerly assistant surgeon in Constitution and now surgeon of Norfolk."
"Of course I remember you, Mr. Butcher," said Jack, his mind filled with the recollection of that painful voyage to Boston as a wounded prisoner after the American Constitution had taken the British Java. "But where is Captain Palmer? Did he survive the wreck of the Norfolk?"
"Oh, yes, yes, he was battered, but not drowned. We didn't lose a very great many people compared with what it might have been. All our clothes went, however, and I am the only man with a respectable coat. That is why I was sent. Captain Palmer couldn't bear the idea of going aboard a British man of war in a torn shirt and no hat. He desires his best compliments, of course. Had the pleasure of meeting you in Boston with Captain Lawrence, and hope you and your officers will dine with him on what the island affords tomorrow at 3 o'clock.
"You spoke of a peace, Mr. Butcher."
"Oh, yes, and he'll tell you about that in more detail than I can. We first had the news from a British whaler. How blank we looked when we had to let her go. A splendid prize. And then from a ship out of Nantucket. But tell me, sir, what is this I hear about Dr. Maturin? That you wish to open his head?"
"He had an ugly fall, and our chaplain, who understands physic, thinks it might save him."
"If it's a question of trepanning, I'm your man. It's an operation I've performed scores, nay, hundreds of times without losing a patient. That's to say, except in a very few cases of vicious cachexy, where it was only done to please the relations. I trepanned Mrs. Butcher for a persistent migraine, and she's never complained since. I have the greatest faith in the operation. It's brought many men back from the edge of the grave, and not only for depressed fractures either. May I see the patient?"
"A very fine instrument indeed," said Butcher to Martin, turning Stephen's trephine over and over in his hands. "With many improvements unknown to me. French, I believe." "I remember our friend," nodding towards Maturin, "saying he'd studied in France. A trifle of snuff, sir?"
"Thank you, but I don't take it. It's my only indulgence," said Butcher. "A very fine instrument. But I don't wonder you hesitated to use it. I should hesitate myself, even in a swell as moderate as this, let alone in the sea you describe. Let's get him ashore at once. This pressure mustn't be allowed to continue another night, or I'll not answer for the consequences."
"Can he safely be moved?"
"Of course he can.
wrapped in blankets, made fast to a padded 6x2 plank with cingulum bandages, a cross piece for his feet, of course, and raised and lowered vertically by tackles, he'll come to no harm. No harm at all, and if Captain Aubrey could send his carpenter to knock up a hut a little more solid than our canvas, why, the patient will be as well off as in any naval hospital.
"Mr. Merritt," said Jack, "I'm going ashore with the doctor. It'll be too dark by the height of flood for you to try the channel, so you'll anchor the ship, gackling your cables a good 20 fathom. In all probability, I shall rejoin when things are well in hand. But if I don't, you'll come in tomorrow evening. Do not forget to gackle your cables, Merritt."
Stephen, more corpse-like still, with his face shrouded from the sun, was lowered into the boat. The launch, this time, as being more roomy than the barge, and it pushed off, loaded deep with the carpenter, his crew, a working party, a good deal of material, and some stores that Jack thought might be welcome to castaways. Captain Palmer had hobbled down to greet him at the landing place, a little hard on the left-hand side of the stream, away from the tents. He'd done what he could to improve his appearance, but he was an unusually hairy man by nature, and a grizzled beard, together with his ragged clothes and bare feet, gave him the look of a vagrant. He had also been miserably bruised and scraped at the time of the wreck, and he was covered with makeshift plasters and bandages, where the coral rock had rasped him to the bone. The hair and the plasters made the expression on his face difficult to interpret, but his words were both polite and obliging.
"I hope, sir," he said, "that you'll come and drink what we have to offer while everything is being fixed. For I conclude the gentleman on the plank under the awning is your surgeon, come ashore to be opened by Mr. Butcher."
"Just so. Mr. Butcher was so very kind as to offer his services, but if you'll forgive me, sir, I must see to some kind of a shelter first while there's still light. Don't stir, I beg," he said, as Palmer made a move to accompany him. "On our way in, I noticed a glade that'll probably answer very well."
"I shall look forward to your visit as soon as you've settled on your place and given your orders," said Palmer with a courtly bow.
This bow was almost the only acknowledgement between the two sides. The small group of men behind Palmer, presumably his remaining officers, uttered no word, while the surviving Norfolks, some 80 or 90 of them, stood at some distance on the right-hand side of the stream. The Surprises stood on the left, and they stared heavily at one another across the water like two unacquainted, potentially hostile bands of cattle. Jack was surprised. In this absurd, unnecessary war, there'd been little real ill-feeling except on the part of the civilians, and he'd expected much more spontaneous pleasure, much more calling out between the hands. He had little time for these reflections, however. The well-drained, open, light, airy place he wanted for his shelter was by no means as easy to find as he'd imagined. The hurricane had littered the ground with branches, some of them huge. There were great trees uprooted and others dangerously unsteady. And it wasn't until late twilight, after driving hard work, that the roof was on and the patient laid out on the solid, sweet-smelling table, newly cut from fresh sandalwood.
"I hope the want of light won't trouble you, Mr. Butcher," said Jack.
"Not at all," said Butcher. "I'm so used to operating between decks that I really prefer a lantern. Mr. Martin, sir, if you will place one there by the beam, while I set the other here, I believe we shall have the benefit of the converging rays. Captain Aubrey, was you to sit on the barrel by the door, you would have an excellent view. You will not have long to wait. As soon as I have put the last edge on this scalpel, I shall make the first incision."
"No," said Jack. "I shall go to see Captain Palmer, and then I must get back to the ship. Please to let me know the moment the operation's over.
Coleman here will wait outside to bring me word.
Certainly, said Butcher. But as for your going back to the ship tonight, never think of it, sir. The flood tide comes in through that channel like a mill race. A boat couldn't possibly row against it, and the wind is foul.
Come along, Blakeney, said Jack to his midshipman.
He closed the door and walked quickly away.
His stomach was strong enough for most purposes, but not for seeing Stephen's scalp turned down over his face inside out and a trephine deliberately cutting into his living bone. At the bottom of the glade they could see the surprises eating their supper in the lee of the launch, the noble fire burning before them. "Cut along and have a bite," said Jack. "Tell them that everything's in train, and when they've finished their supper, let Bondon bring the stores I put up for the Americans."
He walked slowly on, listened to the sea on the distant reef, and sometimes glanced up at the moon just past the full. He liked neither the sound of the one nor the look of the other. Nor did he like the atmosphere on the island. He crossed the stream, still deep in reflection.
"Halt!" cried a sentry. "Who goes there?"
"Friend," replied Jack.
"Pass, friend," said the sentry.
"There you are, sir," said Palmer, ushering him into his tent, lit with a rescued top light turned very low. "You look anxious.
I hope all is well."
"I hope so," said Jack.
"They're operating now."
"They'll send me word as soon as it's over."
"I'm sure all will be well. I've never known Butcher miss a stroke. He is as clever as any surgeon in the service."
"I'm very happy to hear you say so," said Jack. "It shouldn't take long, I believe." His ear was already cocked for approaching footsteps.
"Do you understand tides, Mr. Martin?" asked Butcher, slowly shaving hairs off his forearm with the scalpel.
"Not I," said Martin.
"A fascinating study," said Butcher. "Here they're particularly curious, being neither semi-diurnal nor quite diurnal. There is an immense reef to the west of this island, and I believe it is that which pens up the current and causes the anomaly. But whether it is that or a whole raft of other factors, a spring tide like tonight's comes in with great force, torrential force, and the flow lasts 9 hours or more. It will not be high water till morning, and your captain is, as one might say, marooned for the night. Will you take snuff, sir?"
"Thank you, sir," said Martin. "I never do." "Mine was a waterproof box, glory be," said Butcher, turning Stephen's head and considering it with pursed lips. "I always fortify myself before operating. Some gentlemen smoke a cigar. I prefer snuff."
He opened his box and took so vast a pinch that a good deal fell down his shirt front and more on his patient. He flapped it off both with his handkerchief, and Stephen gave a tiny sneeze. Then, painfully, he drew a deeper breath, sneezed like a Christian, muttered something about spoonbills, and brought his hand up to cover his eyes, saying, "Jesus, Mary and Joseph," in his usual harsh, grating voice, though very low.
"Pin him," cried Butcher, "or he'll be sitting up."
And through the door to Pardine.
"Hey there, go fetch a rope."
"Maturin," said Martin, bending over him, "you've come to yourself. How happy I am. I've prayed for this. You had a great fall, but are now recovered."
"Put out that goddamn light," said Stephen. "Come, sir, lie back and set your mind at ease.
said Butcher.
"We must relieve the pressure on your brain. Just a little discomfort, a little restraint. It'll soon be over."
But he spoke without much hope. And when Stephen did sit up, desiring Paddy not to stand there in the door like a great dumb ox, but to fetch him a draught of good fresh water for the love of God, he put down his scalpel, saying quietly, "Now I shall never have a chance of using the new French trephine." After a silent pause, Captain Palmer said, "Well, sir, and how did your ship come through this blow?"
"Pretty well, I thank you, upon the whole, apart from some lost spars and a sprung mizzen. But most of the storm had already passed over, somewhat to the north, I believe. We only caught the southern skirt, or the tail."
"We were in the heart of it. Or rather, the forefront, since we had no warning. And it hit us at night. A sad time we had of it, as you may imagine, particularly as we were short-handed, having sent so many men away. Palmer hardly liked to say in prizes, so he repeated, having sent so many men away, merely changing the stress. It was evident from his account that the typhoon had struck the Norfolk much earlier than the surprise. It had also set her far north of her reckoning, so that on the Thursday morning, when they were driving before an enormous sea with no more than a scrap of sail on the stump of the foremast, to their surprise and horror they saw old Sudbury's Island fine on the starboard bow."
"This island, sir?" Palmer nodded.
"So you knew it, then?"
"I knew of it, sir. The whalers sometimes come here. Indeed, it is named for Reuben Sodbury of Nantucket. But they usually avoid it because of the very long and dangerous shoals a few miles to the west, shoals that were right under our lee. So rather than run plumb onto them with no hope at all, we bore up for old Sodbury. Two of my men, whalers from New Bedford, had been there before, and they knew the pass." He shook his head and then went on, "Still, we did at least strike at the very tail of the ebb, so most of us could scramble from the bows to the little island, and so along the reef to the shore. But we saved nothing. No boats, no stores, no clothes, almost no tools, no tobacco."
"Haven't you been able to dive for anything?"
"No, sir, no. The place is alive with sharks, the grey kind, old Sodbury's sharks. My second and the midshipman tried at low water. They didn't leave us enough to bury, though they weren't big fish. I heard the sentries, 'Halt! Who goes there?' Followed by a strangled gasp, then the sound of blows and Bondon's strong, 'Now then, mate, who are you a-shoving of? Don't you know he's dumb?' 'Why didn't he say so, then?' said the sentry in a faint voice. 'Let me up.' Padin burst in and touched his forehead with a bleeding knuckle. He brought out no clear word, but his message was plain on his shining face, and in any case Bondon was there to interpret. 'He means the doctor wasn't opened at all, sir. Recovered by himself, sprang up like a fairy, damned everyone all round, called for water, called for coconut milk, and is now asleep, no visitors allowed, which I brought to stores, sir. And, sir, it may be turning dirty outside.' 'Thank you, both of you. You couldn't have brought better news. I shall be with you presently, Bondon. Now, here, sir,' opening the chest, 'are some little things we brought along. No caviar or champagne, I'm afraid, but this is smoked seal, and this salt pork and dolphin sausage. Rum! Port wine! And tobacco!' cried Palmer. 'Bless you, Captain Aubrey. I sometimes thought I should never see them again. Allow me to freshen your coconut milk with some of this excellent rum, and then, if I may, I'll call in my officers, the few I still have, and introduce them.' Jack smiled while Palmer was uncorking the bottle. It was not what he was about to say that made him so cheerful, but rather the thought of Stevens sitting up and cursing. The rum was poured, the mixture stirred.
Composing his face, Jack said, "There's something one might almost say sacred about wine or grog or even perhaps beer that water or coconut milk doesn't possess. So before I drink with you, it is but right that I should say you must consider yourself a prisoner of war. Of course, I shall not proceed to extremes. I shall not insist upon your coming back to the ship with me tonight, for example, or anything of that kind. No manacles, no irons or bilboes." This with a smile, although in fact the Constitution had handcuffed the captured seamen from the Java. "Yet I thought I should make the position clear."
"But, my dear sir, the war is over," cried Palmer.
"So I hear," said Jack after a slight pause in a less cordial voice. "But I have no official knowledge of it, and your sources may be mistaken. And as you know, hostilities continue until they are countermanded by one's superior officers." Once again, Palmer spoke of the British whaler, the Vega of London, that had lain to for him and had told him of the peace, had shown him a newspaper bought in Acapulco, fresh from New York, with an account of the treaty. And he spoke of the Nantucket ship, whose officers and men all talked about it as a matter of course. He spoke in great detail and most earnestly. "Obviously," he said, "I cannot argue with 28 great guns, but I hope I can reason with the officer who commands them, unless he is only concerned with bloodshed and destruction."
"Certainly," said Jack, "but you must know that even the most humane of officers is required to do his duty, and that his duty may sometimes be very disagreeable to his feelings."
"He is also required to use discretion," said Palmer. "Everyone has heard of those miserable killings in the remote parts of the world long after peace has been signed, deaths that every decent man must regret. Ships sunk or burnt too, or taken only to be given back after endless delay and loss. Aubrey, don't you see that if you use your superior strength to carry us back to Europe, just at a time when this wretched, unhappy war has been patched up, your action will be as bitterly resented in the States as the Leopard's when she fired into the Chesapeake?" This was a shrewd blow. At one time Jack had commanded that unlucky ship, a two-decker carrying 50 guns, and he knew very well that one of his predecessors, Salisbury Humphreys, had been ordered to recover some deserters from the Royal Navy from the American Chesapeake, a 36-gun frigate. The American commander was unwilling to have his ship searched, and the Leopard fired 3 broadsides into her, killing or wounding 21 of her people. She succeeded in recovering some of the deserters, but the incident very nearly caused a war and did, in fact, close all United States ports to British men of war. It also meant the shore for most of the officers concerned, including the Admiral. Conceivably, Captain Humphreys was just within his legal right firing upon the Chesapeake, said Palmer. "I don't know. I'm no lawyer. And conceivably you would be within the strict letter of yours if you were to carry us to Europe as prisoners. But I cannot think that such a cheap victory over unarmed shipwrecked men would be much to the honour of your service, or would give you much satisfaction. No, sir. What I hope you will do is use your wide powers of discretion and carry us to Huahiva in the Marquesas, not 100 leagues away, where I have friends and can shift for myself and my men. Or, if you don't like that, then I hope you will at least leave us here and let our friends know where they can find us. For I presume you will now go home by the Cape, passing close by the Marquesas. We can hold out here for a month or two, although food is short because of the hurricane. Think it over, sir. Sleep on it, I beg. And in the meantime, let's drink a health to Dr. Maturin." At these words, a most enormous lightning flash lit up his anxious face. "With all my heart," said Jack, draining his coconut shell and standing up. "I must get back to the ship." Long and vehement thunder drowned the beginning of Palmer's reply, but Jack did catch the words, "should have told you before,"
9 or 10 hour flood impossible to pull against in the channel, pray accept of this bed, pointing to a heap of leaves covered with sailcloth.
Thank you, but I shall go and ask for news of Maturin, said Jack.
On leaving the trees, he looked out beyond the white line of the reef for the Surprise's riding light, and when his eyes grew used to the darkness, he made it out low in the west like a setting star.
I'm sure Mowat would have gackled his cables, he said.
The launch had been hauled well above the high water mark and turned bottom up on broken palm trees, so that it formed a low but commodious house. Its copper could be seen gleaming in the moon, and from beneath the gunwale the acrid smoke of a dozen pipes drifted to leeward. Bondon was walking up and down at some distance, waiting for him.
"Dirty weather, sir," he said.
"Yes," said Jack, and they both stared up at the moon, peering now and then through racing, whirling cloud, though down here there was no more than a shifting, uneasy breeze.
"Looks very like the mixture as before.
You've heard about the 9 hour tide, I collect?"
"Yes, sir. Very nasty piece of work caught me up when I was coming back from the tent. An Englishman, he told me. Also said he was a Hermione, and there was several more in the Norfolk, a score or so apart from other deserters. Said he'd point them out if you would hold him safe and guarantee he'd get the reward. They were main terrified at the sight of Surprise, thought she was a Russian ship at first and cheered, then grew main terrified when they saw what she really was."
"I'm sure they did.
What did you say to this Hermione?"
"Told him I'd tell you, sir."
The heavens lit from rim to rim, showing a vast solid blackness rushing across the sky from the southeast. Both ran for shelter. But before Jack could reach his, the wall of rain caught him and soaked him through. With ludicrous precaution, he silently opened and closed the door and stood dripping there in the hut, while the hissing roar of falling water and the crash of thunder filled the outside world. With equal absurdity, Martin, reading a book by a shaded lantern, put his fingers to his lips and pointed at Stephen, lying there curled on his side, sleeping peacefully, naturally, and occasionally smiling. All night he slept, though a rough night it was, as rough as Jack had known, and noisier. For when the wind really began, which it did with a sudden shriek at 1 in the morning, it had not only the masts and rigging of a ship to howl through, but all the island's remaining trees and bushes, while the tremendous surf, coming more from the south than it had before, produced a ground base of equal enormity, more to be felt with one's whole being than really heard through the screaming wind and the headlong crash of trees.
"What was that?"
asked Martin, when the hut reverberated with hammer blows during a particularly violent blast.
"Coconuts," said Jack. "Thank God Lamb made such a good job of the roof. They're mortal in a breeze like this."
Stephen slept through the coconuts, slept through the first bleary light of dawn. But he opened an eye during the lull that came with the sunrise, said, "Good morning to you now, Jack," and closed it again. With the same precautions as before, Jack crept out of the door into the streaming, wind-wrecked landscape. He hurried ankle-deep down to the shore, where he observed that the launch hadn't moved. And there, standing on the broad bole of a fallen tree and bracing himself against a still unbroken palm, he searched the white, torn ocean with his pocket-glass. To and fro he swept the horizon, watching until every trough in the swell became a rise. Near and far, north and south. But there was never a ship on the sea.